at Auburn was hilarious. Hey, we live.
We are live.
Church.
What time is it around the world, Toby?
10:30 a.m. West Coast, 1:30 p.m. East Coast. I think 3:30 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, 5:30 p.m. UTC. I looked it up. It's going to be true for like a few months and then it all changes again. It's value after hours.
7:30 a.m. my time.
Oof. Still on the Hawaii time right now.
Yeah.
That's not so bad. It's living.
Well, the problem is I'm currently in Florida.
So what about for your kids? What
the bot, I was not kids. Nice to them last night.
Are they waking up at like,
you know, no, you know, 4 year olds, you know how they just whine and whine and whine and whine? Well, like after 19 and a half hours of travel and no sleep, I wasn't having it. And I probably could have been more compassionate. Oh, well. One of a long list of mistakes.
Townsville, Queensland in the house. Wow. Prince of Island, Alaska.
Wow. There we go.
Casuarina prison in Perth. Good to see you, Stewie. Nashville.
The Alaskan nice. Fan is tuning in to figure out what he's going to do, or she. Shouldn't assume it's a he. Ryan with Baxter. All the oil money.
It's a he.
Yeah.
We know our demographic here. Come on.
Statistically speaking, you're right.
Yeah.
You'd be the outlier. There's a couple women that listen. Shout out to y'all.
Literally
thank you.
A couple.
Yeah, well, I think there's four. So 40% of the
40%,
fans.
That's pretty good.
That's not bad. Not big bad.
Big numbers. Bigly. What's on anything, tap for today, boys?
Anything, yeah. So the one thing that I saw a tweet from Cliff Asness about interest rates jacking up, and that, you know, that was the, you know, the theory was super low interest rates, what keeps the stock market up, and now interest rates are up and stock market's still up. So we've debunked that one too. But when I had a look at the 10-year, the 10-year is at 2.9.
It's going higher.
I remember when it went through two.
Yeah.
So
it's been quick.
Over the last decade, it's been over three on two occasions. It's got just over three, like 3.07, 3.06 in 2013 and 2018. And then it rapidly got stomped on after that. So I don't know if this is like, they've just decided that the Fed's decided that three is as high as it can go, or if that was just like something, that's what happens. But anyway, it's interesting to see what's going to happen.
Dudley say yesterday? I thought he said 3.5 was where the short term rate should be. No, well,
what are they saying for short term? What are they calling short term? That's not 10-year run.
I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out because, you know, there are a bunch of tweets and I'm trying to go to the actual source.
Speaking of funny tweets about that, I think Morgan Housel had one about, he's like, if you told someone in 2011 that mortgage rates were at 5%, they would say, wow, how'd they get down that low?
Yeah.
True.
So it's not always what floor of the elevator you're on. It's which direction is the elevator going often.
Yeah. What direction is the elevator going in?
Penthouse, going up? Apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Why is this so hard to figure out? You want the short thesis on Google? I typed in Dudley FOMC speech. It wasn't at the FOMC, so maybe that's on me. But I can't get what I need if this is not good.
Stockholm, what's happening? Nashville, Abu Dhabi. We got a good
worldwide
good spread. Eastern Germany.
He did mention, speaking of the elevator, that, you know, he thought the economy had a long way to go.
Which way?
Up or down? Good question. Unclear.
I mean,
it's hard to see inflation. Like the last print from inflation was 8.5%. I'm pretty, you know, bearish inflationista, whatever. But it's hard to see inflation maintaining at that rate for like. That's we're all being set on fire at that rate. It's got to come down from there, but it's still going to be high.
What if you shut down the world's factory in the form of China and COVID? What's that do for your inflation predictions?
Yeah, I'd have to withdraw it at that point. But Some of these things are just too terrible to think about, I think. Just have to hope they don't happen.
Well, I mean, it's kind of happening, though. I don't think that hopium gets you out of this.
Well, then inflation's going to run a lot hotter.
Yeah, or it doesn't. One of the two.
Well, it's like the print, I didn't read all of Einhorn's letter. I just saw his Q1 letter came out April 19. So that's today. And I just started reading it before he came on. He says the markets are predicting 5.3% inflation through the end of the year.
What does that mean? Like looking at like treasury futures or something?
Yeah. I can't remember exactly how, but it was there's some instrument that will give you the market's prediction, but he said the market was predicting 3.5% a year ago. So
it's, you know, genius.
The market's not going to be right. 5.3 is pretty hot.
That is hot.
It's all a matter of why, right? I guess. I don't know. I don't know anything. Dennis Hong said his circle of competence he defines as his ability to predict an accurate statistical range. I'm pretty sure that's what he said. And I got to thinking about that and I determined I have no circles of competence.
It's hard.
Yeah, no, I'm not kidding. I don't think I have any.
Well, I mean, that's not true. You go your entire life, you're
going, I can't fucking predict
probabilistic
accurately
about
tomorrow.
Well, yeah.
I'm almost certain the sun will come up. That's like one area of competence that I have.
We can build off of that.
Yeah. So I got that going for me.
The earth will continue to turn.
Or if it doesn't, it doesn't matter.
You got bigger problems.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'm not even kidding. I thought about that. And I was like,
here's another thing, like sun coming up, earth continue to turn, value spread continues to blow out. Value spread at all-time highs. So this is from the Alpha Architect website. I pulled it up last week just because I was interested to see whether, because they the end of every month they update the data. And so the spread now is wider.
You just have
than
a little calendar reminder that says self-flagellation.
I'm just like, why am I underperforming? Let me go have a quick look. And so it's now the data goes back to 1992. The spread is wider now than at any other point in the data.
You keep telling me that like every time we talk about it.
It's this is how you get there though. Like it keeps on going up, but the significance, like we're now well through 19. This is measured on EBIT to total enterprise value since 1992, monthly, year end, US domestic stock. It is now wider than it has been at any point in the data, like by a very wide margin, including 2000 and 2007 or 2009, whenever the kind of little peak was through there. And then it's now extended over the EAFE data as well, which I didn't think was going to happen. I sort of thought that we'd see because the US market's been quite strong. So it's been everything outside of the US has been suffering in comparison, but it's now extended past that as well.
That's really surprising to me. Isn't like I would have thought that top decile has been blown out now in a lot of ways, wouldn't you?
And this because it includes energy.
Let me use a better word than blown up. No, the most expensive decile would have been beaten up enough to not have such a wide spread.
Yes, so the significance of this spread is it's the value spread relative to the market.
Oh, okay. So it's only from halfway to downward, then, not the top and the bottom.
Right.
Okay. Well,
because it's EBIT rather than book or other measures of value, it's not going to include a lot of energy. So the spread in there, they're saying it's like,
it's the a flow, yield not on, a.
The yield's like 15.5% across that decile versus it was like 4, I think, for the market, which is very significant. Anyway, wow. I think that continues to be a pretty good opportunity. Getting better every month.
A lot of cyclicals in that, right?
Must be. Yeah.
Yeah.
No one's buying it.
I think everybody's scared, man. I mean, not of everything, obviously. Somebody's laughing out there. They're like, oh, that's a stupid comment. Look at how expensive everything is. Well, I get that, but I don't, there's not too much bullish sentiment out there. And I don't see a lot of people being like, we're going to be fine through these rate hikes. There's a lot of people that are like, well, what are rates going to do to everything? There's a big boogeyman that I think people are looking at. I think some of it's, I mean, I just What's said the that my circle of competence is zero, right?
What's the boogeyman? What's the
main Their rates boogeyman? Are going to kill everything.
You know, what's weird about that, though, is that they, so like you see the bull and bear AAII sentiment and like it's super bearish right now, right? And yet exposures, I think, are still pretty heavily tilted to equities. So like people are just saying it, but then I think they're kind of not backing it up with their money. So I don't know. Like it's.
Is that auto investment into like the index?
I think a lot of it is.
Could be.
Sure. I think a lot of it is.
I mean, that's probably a good thing that people are, even if they feel one way, they're still doing the other.
Yeah. What did Mike say on the Twitter machine? Talk bearish, act bullish, get rich.
That is kind of maybe what's happening. It feels like, I don't know. A lot of this stuff is so like, I feel like the data sets of it are pretty noisy. So it's hard to like really write a good narrative out of it, but.
I mean, I think that there's legitimate concern around if the Fed, like if mortgage rates trickle through the housing cycle, typically housing will lead economic cycles. So you just haven't seen it in the data yet. And it's coming.
Why does housing lead the economic cycle?
It's got a huge multiplier effect, man. There's a ton of labor that's like directly employed by housing and they spend quickly. It's, you know, the laborers tend not to be people that are saving as much. So they're spending most of their raises. You get a lot of transitory labor into and out of construction, I think. So you get a lot of like
marginal.
Maybe somebody would be in a restaurant and now they're in construction and, then I think you probably have some refi impact, some wealth effect. I don't know. The wealth effect's a little funky, though, because typically I don't think, and I haven't really looked at this, maybe 2007 changes, but that would be the only time. Like, really, sales velocity decreases when housing hits a tough patch. Prices don't tend to come down that much because people just don't sell.
That was the question. That was the point that I was going to make, or the question I was going to ask. That typically, what I see, or what tends to happen, is that the stock market crashes and it takes the property market, real estate market, another year before it bottoms because it's a less liquid market. It takes longer to clear.
Yeah, well, and like now, if you've locked your rates in, like, you know, I don't know that people are eager to sell.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out: is someone ever going to come up with Let's say that rates do, and especially if this is true that the Fed wants to get out of the mortgage market. And if that's the case, like, boy, I have to imagine rates could be quite a bit higher. So imagine like we have the scenario where people want to move and they have good reason to move, but they do not want to, no one wants to give up their mortgage. Like, would we almost need another product or something that would allow you to keep that same mortgage and transfer it or in some kind of escrow? I don't know exactly how it could work, but it seems like that might be a business that would make some sense. Like, take this mortgage comes with the house and you just like assume the whole thing and you're going to assume someone else's that's also lower.
Yeah. I don't think there's been too many assumption of mortgages clauses. Mortgages are kind of interesting, right? Because when you buy them, if rates go down, right, if you're long the mortgage debt, when rates go down, people refi you and your duration shortens.
Yeah,
and
you're on the wrong end of a call option there.
Yeah, like you're always on the wrong end, though, because if you bought them at two...
The borrower's got the right side of that, right? The lender's got the bad side of it. That's what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah, because the buyer always has the option to put it to the lender. And then, like, if you bought it, you know... pack of mortgages when they were at 2.9 or whatever, you know, if you have any duration in that, it's going to get extended if mortgage rates go to 6. Like, I'm sure people make money buying that stuff, but I don't fully understand how outside of levering it and hoping.
Fixed rates, fixed rate mortgages as the standard is, I'd never encountered that before in Australia. Like you could get a fixed rate for 5 years, but you pay a premium for it. And what I understood was that you never get the fixed rate because you always pay over a full mortgage. You always pay lower rates at the variable rate because you don't have to pay the premium. And so the US has Fannie Mae and all of these other government GSEs or whatever they're called that lend into that market because they wouldn't do it otherwise. It's non-commercial.
Yeah, we subsidize our housing market considerably relative to other countries.
Yeah. I think it's a reasonably decent policy, but that's not a well thought out comment.
I think you're right. I think there's something about home ownership and skin in the game in your community and kind of giving a shit about what you know, that you're a member there and some stabilities. I think it's actually not I'm pretty anti meddling in human affairs by government, but in this instance, I'm not sure it's that bad.
Well, you want an asset liability match, right? You don't want like a long dated asset that all of a sudden you've got some crash and like, you know, a bunch of people have to refi their 5 year debt and you're like, fuck.
Well, that's what happened in 2008.
Everyone was on arms and
yeah. And like, I don't think we've gotten to the point where credit conditions have been super loose yet. I think the underwriting is still quite good. On average, we may be getting there. If rates go up, people may start to look at more exotic debt products. But to date, I don't think that's a real risk yet.
I didn't finish this part of Einhorn's letter, but Einhorn was writing about the home builders in particular. And he said the reason that they're cheap, because people are scared of like a 2007-2009 type scenario. And he said he didn't think that was likely because there'd been such a huge underinvestment. And lending was much stricter, but that was what I was reading before I jumped on here. I haven't finished it yet. So there may be a curveball by the end of it. There may be a punchline that is different to that.
Psych.
But I think that's interesting from Einhorn.
I think that's probably right.
Cause Einhorn was very bearish. He was short all of that stuff through 7, 8, 9. So I tend to listen to him a little bit on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think you can look at the data and think we're going to have a big housing crash. You may have an illiquidity bubble. I mean, that's a big problem, but I just don't think.
The problem with this stuff though, is that it's never really predictable beforehand. I don't think so either, but when it happens, we'll revisit this like in 4 years time, people are like, they had no idea.
Well, if you have some catastrophic event and all of a sudden, but then you're just going to have illiquidity, right? I guess then the home builders have to complete all these houses that they've started but have not completed, and they're sitting on a bunch of inventory that's high cost because they paid up for the land and they paid up for the materials, and now you got no bidders. I guess that's possible, but I think if you're going to make that argument, you really have a lot of burden of proof on you outside of, I feel this is going to happen.
I don't disagree. And I own a lot of home builders, so I like that argument too. But just like to aerate the other side too.
So I have no circle of competence, so I don't even know what I'm talking about.
What do HELOCs look like right now? I thought I saw a chart that like there'd been a fair amount of money taken out in the last few years.
Oh, there've been a ton of refis,
which then, you know, I mean, that has to be pretty stimulative for the rest of goods and services. Like, I don't know, take that away or you have to pay some of that back, and now all of a sudden, like, oh boy, we have a little bit less demand for all this other stuff.
Yeah, I think you can make a valid argument that you believe that demand is temporarily too high and we've pulled forward a lot of it. And when things slow, we're going into recession. And okay. I mean, but I guess, haven't we kind of proven the fact that we can overstimulate the economy if we need to?
How many times can you do that?
I mean, that's kind of the problem.
How many times can you give the kids another Coke when it's late at night before they crash anyway?
I have no idea.
Cola, okay.
I got a good comment here. New buyer incentives, pool landscaping rate buy down happened before developers drop prices. Watch for the homeowner incentives to appear. That will signal the top. I saw something that there were a large...
Hang on. Repeat that, please.
New buyer incentives happen before developers drop prices. So they start offering free stuff before prices come down. But that's the sort of...
Yeah.
That's the harbinger for something bad's going to happen. I did see that the number of speculative homes was high. This is developers who bought and redeveloped the place or refurbished the place to flip it.
Yeah, that but that's high-ish. Because there's no fucking inventory. Like days on market are like savage.
Yeah, it's as low as it's ever been.
Out of Logan, but I mean, he's right. I mean, it's like savagely unhealthy. I mean, we're not more than a month after I was talking to my buddy who's a buyer's agent. Shout out to Jason Dalby in Denver. If you need a house, buy it from Jason. Actually don't, because he probably won't rep you. I mean, he straight up was like, I don't do buyers right now. I cannot do it because I can't write an offer that's aggressive enough. And like, he doesn't feel right repping a buyer and basically saying, we'll pay whatever you want with whatever terms you want. And there's no cap on this and it's cash only. Like, those are the kind of offers that are getting accepted. That's insanity.
Yeah.
So, like, slowing that a little makes sense to me.
Yeah. For sure.
This too shall pass.
But I don't know if you slow that, does that mean catastrophe? Or does it just mean that you're slowing something a little? I don't know.
It's hard to tell, right? At the margins, what happens? Like, the margins of the thing dictate what we see. That's the marginal buyer and seller getting together. But it doesn't necessarily speak for the bulk. Where 2007, 8, 9 seemed to be, there was just so much speculation out there. Whereas I don't think there is that much speculation now. There's just not a lot of liquidity, which is kind of like jacking up prices.
Yeah, the one thing that that I do think that people get a little fast and loose with is people are like, oh, well, you know, there's a lot of cash buyers. I mean, what is really a cash offer? I guess you back it up with some proof of funds, but like, it's not really cash. You know, unless you're showing somebody a bank account that's segregated funds that is actually cash.
It's just not subject to finance, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah. So... like,
you just got the financing already lined up.
Yeah. And I just think that people associate cash with like true cash that's not equities and
this
has nowhere to go.
Shoebox full of money.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's just shorthand for we'll get it done, whatever we have to do, which works unless there's a big correction.
How long until we think the supply chain starts to heal? We build more homes and that'll slow the craze. I don't know. A while, a few years.
Yeah, well, I
think it takes a while to build a home.
A couple things on this. I mean, I don't know why anyone would listen to me. I have no circle of competence and I've been way wrong on this.
Proceed.
I think the supply chain has been getting better. But to Jake's point, like now you've got China coming off. Line. Let's talk about lumber, something that's never been discussed on this podcast. Do we think that Russia coming offline is good for aggregate lumber supply?
Do we get a little lumber from Russia?
They got a lot of natural resources. It's probably not an incrementally good thing. Do we think that the UK, like,
what about
Ukraine
Canada coming
destroyed?
Off?
Wait, Ukraine being destroyed and having all those people fleeing. Does that create like any housing demand? You got to put them somewhere. You probably have to build something. It's hard for it to be like a
negative.
Yes,
for Poland. I don't know about the U.S.
Well, I'm not saying the U.S., but it's a global market, right?
Okay.
I accept it somewhat local because it's heavy to ship. So then we go to this side of the world. You've got huge housing shortages. Days on market is, 30
measured in hours.
Today. Yeah. I mean, housing starts have been over 1.6 forever. Completions is the problem. Canada, I mean, it's hard to argue that the west side of Canada is getting competitive. So then you got all this stuff in the southeast that can maybe come online, but how are you going to get the labor to actually get this mill done and to actually get the truckers to move it around? Like, I mean, I don't know. We'll see.
Are you saying that there's fragility in some of our systems that we've erected over the last?
Yeah, I will say that smarter people than me think lumber at 300 is more probable in the summer than lumber at 800. So I wouldn't be shocked if we have a sell-off. But if lumber goes to 300, I don't know what it looks like after that. Because presumably some people are going to get knocked out of production, which is all a long-winded way of saying, I think that housing starts, I mean, completions are almost built in for a while, I think, unless builders just shut it down, which is possible, but I don't think it's probable.
It's been funny looking at the daily chart of some commodity that's gone absolutely bananas on Twitter. Like this, it was milk today. Milk has shot straight up.
Yeah.
Don't know why milk would be.
Well, there's this idea in economics called cobweb effects. And what it is that as if there's a lag at all in supply or demand, how it shifts, then you'll see the price move pretty dramatically. And it almost ends up making this kind of like almost looks like a cobweb, like a spider would build. And so
overcorrecting.
There's overcorrection. Supply will, you know, if you can't put it on right away when demand is there, you're going to have a price change, and then eventually it catches up and overshoots, and now it moves back the other direction. And it's equilibrium is only a thing that you just move through occasionally.
Right.
So I would expect more volatility in all of this stuff than less. I mean, even if it goes lower, maybe it's goes lower harder and then goes back the other direction. I mean, I think these fluctuations are, I think the stability is the rare occurrence, and that, you know, this type of fluctuation is probably more the norm.
I mean, that run up in the 10-year, that's one thing that's an incredible ramp. Every time I check in, I expect that to have broken, but it's still sort of ramping up. Like that 2 to 3, like I remember when we were talking about going through 2, that was this year, wasn't it?
It was like 2 weeks ago.
JT, you want to do your...
Yes, sir.
The Bullard, the presentation, I think, is worth looking at. You can find that, I'm pretty sure, at St. Louis Fed.org. I had one more thing. Fuck it. It doesn't matter.
We'll get back to it.
Yeah. Oh, my buddies at Trade Oil, they say that there's a lot less liquidity in the market right now. And I just kind of wonder if there's some combination of a lack of liquidity plus...
What does that mean? That supply for like...
Just like traders. Like.
Okay.
My buddy said that it's so algo-driven now that if he puts in an actual bid, he can like watch the entire market respond to his bid. Now he's trading like a super niche product. It's TASS, which is traded settlement. It's only like 30 minutes of the day that he trades every day. But like he is a specialist in that market. And he was just saying that like there's a lot less liquidity than he's ever seen in his career. And I kind of wonder if that's going on a lot of places. And then if it is, I was listening to Soros speak about reflexivity, and he said that like bubbles, he actually thinks are very rational, because if you think a bubble is coming, it's the rational thing to do is pile in and make a bunch of money. And I kind of wonder if like some of these spikes are, I just don't know how much of it's like people that see market structure issues and they're exploiting them, and they can just push the market much further, much faster than they used to be able to.
Because of the lack of depth to it.
Yeah. And if you have some access to leverage or something, and you just know that you can pound the book, like, I would probably do it if I knew how. I don't. And I have no circle. I have a square.
Square of confidence.
A dodecahedron of confidence.
Anyway, that's all I got.
All right. Veggies for today are this concept called antagonistic pleiotropy. And sounds very complicated. It's not as complicated as it sounds. But where it came from is that there's been a lot of talk, I feel like, lately, and this is what happens kind of during any regime change, I think, but that there's a lot of talk about like, oh, everyone needs to evolve with the changing times as an investor. And that sounds right, doesn't it? I mean, oh, of course, like you need to evolve and keep up with everything. But evolve is an interesting choice of words for this, because what do you guys think about when you think of evolution? Like, what's the phrase that comes to mind?
Survival of the fittest.
Correct.
However, I just think a style drift in this case. All I hear is underperformance.
Yeah. Don't spoil the punchline. No, but Toby's right that survival of the fittest is often what's thought of, but that's actually wrong. And it's wrong because it's more about reproduction and passing on your genes. So imagine any organism that is living for centuries but doesn't reproduce, it's effectively evolutionarily invisible at that point, right? So survival is not necessarily what matters in this. So the difference between survival and reproduction can be shown with this antagonistic pleiotropy, which I will just call AP to shorten it for the rest of this segment. One, because it's hard to say, and two, because we don't have time for that. So AP is, or it comes from Greek actually, which means like more and turning. And so what it means like kind of like multiple paths in a way. And so the difference, so AP, like it comes from traits that increase your productive fitness at the expense though of later in life, like decreasing lifespan. Okay. So a classic example would be in primates, your prostate in a primate, which we are primates, has an increased metabolic rate. And how that helps you be more reproductive is that actually increases sperm motility. But it comes with the downside of later in life, that higher metabolic rate will create more incidence of cancer, right? So you passed it on into the future, but you know, like it's not good for you in your survival of the fittest. Okay. So another classic example would be salmon who swim upstream this epic journey to spawn and then they die. Another one actually is Huntington's disease, where people with Huntington's disease actually have a lower incidence of cancer when they're younger than average, and actually have higher fecundity, which is like better breeding, like have more kids. But it comes at the cost later. This genetic mutation causes neurodegenerative diseases in later in life that are actually pretty horrific. So we have like increased fitness in the short run, but in that same expression, genetic expression causes a compromise long term. So when I think about, I did a little like just kind of playing around with return streams over like, let's say a 30-year period of, you know, your kind of investment horizon. And I did a thing where let's say that you had Hall of Fame returns 30% a year for 4 years, and every fifth year you had a minus 70%, like you just got the shit kicked out of you, right? And I think that there are some people who sort of follow this strategy that is like very high variance. It's like when you're winning, like you look like a genius, right? Like you are killing it. But when it doesn't work out, you get absolutely monkey hammered. And what ends up happening then is like if you do this sort of like 4 good years, 1 bad year, and you play that out for 30 years, a 30-70 up and down, you actually end up at year 30, you're down 60% total. It's pretty rough. And if the further that it would go, actually, the further you would go down this curve, like towards zero. Now, contrast that with sort of style B, which was 5% upside every year and a 10% drawdown. So much tighter ranges of variance. By the year 30, you're up 71%. Okay, it's not like you crushed it for a 30-year period. Cumulative 71% is not much. However, you made it much, much farther into it. And I think, you know, you had probably been fired well before if you were running that, you know, 30 up, 70 down time period. Now you might be saying like, well, every 5 years, like that's unrealistic. Like you're not going to get clobbered every 5 years. Okay. I did another little run that was 25% per year for 9 years and then down 80% on that 10th year. So like you look like a genius for long stretches of time and then you get hammered every 10 years. You have a bad year. That turned into a cumulative 230% by the end of 30 years. Okay, like not too shabby. It's okay. However, like contrast that with style B, which I would say is probably maybe more what like I think Buffett has tried to run most of his career, which is 8% upside, especially as he's gotten bigger. Let me preface that. 8% upside, 9 out of 10 years. So pretty modest ambitions, I would say. And 20% downside every that 10th year. You end up with a 309% total return over that 30 years. So you end up like pretty materially outperforming this other higher variance strategy. This has been called variance drain in other contexts. I think what it shows is that there are certain strategies that can like make you sort of like short-term look like very successful and do really well, but long-term you're going to end up paying for it a little bit in the way that antagonistic pleiotropy applies. So I would say that like we may be seeing that little bit of a turning point in that, you know, maybe we had that period where the first 4 to 10 years or whatever, 4 to 9 years where it was like shoot the lights out type of strategies worked really well. To go back to Bill's point about style drift, like, is it really time to be evolving more towards that? Or maybe still like being a little bit more, you know, down the center, smaller variance is still maybe a smart thing to do. It's kind of up to you and your own personality, but just at least know what you're doing.
When you're constructing that, is there some significance about the size of the up year versus the size of the down year?
Well, I mean, the bigger the up year, the bigger the down year that you can afford to still not.
But are they in the same scale? Like, is the 5 down to the 20 the same as a 25 to 80? Or whatever the case may be.
Well, I mean, you can play around with different, like,
down 80 is bad. You like pretty much wiped out.
Down 80 is bad.
I don't think we talked about what happens though if I increase my Twitter follower count during those up 25 years, and then I launch some Substack products and maybe hold some conferences, and then maybe I'm in an LP structure, and then I have fund 2, and I say I just had a bad year and I'm about to get ready to go again. I get my 2 and 20 maybe, or just
I've learned,
you know,
all
my
0-6-20
on the first. Like, you can get pretty rich in that first strategy.
John Merriweather did it 3 times.
Yeah. So yeah. ELPs may not, but the GP can make it out pretty well.
That's right.
Gotta be good at sales.
If you're a good salesman, that's what I was gonna say. Then you
that's
can
right.
You can have multiple bites of that apple.
For the book Concentrated Investing, I built this little Monte Carlo simulation of the different bet sizing. You know, so you can have Martingale, reverse Martingale, like a fixed sum of your book that you bet regardless of what happens, or you have Kelly or half Kelly, right?
Yeah.
And I built it so that it would give me 1,000 runs, and then I could refresh and it would give me another 1,000 runs. So I played with it a lot over a few days after I built it. And it was amazing how it's like on average over the full set, and I collected all of them into a chart, which is in the book. You definitely do better with Kelly.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how many times you run it at Kelly. Like, and this is when I say like you run it once, it's 1,000 trades in sequence over probably a lifetime. So yeah. It's amazing how many times, like even though you know that it's the better strategy on average over the full set, how many times it underperforms. It was a little bit humbling watching it run. Actually, I was like, this is that makes me a little bit nervous.
So implicitly Kelly is the median expected version of that, right? Like, so it looks very good, but you can end up on either end of that median,
right? And half Kelly's no better. Like, it looked to me like
half Kelly just kind of squeezes the lower and higher levels together, right?
Kelly's supposed to be the optimal return for risk, and half Kelly is supposed to be some like half of a volatility, but you must be truncating your return more because it's not optimal. It's definitionally not optimal, but it's still
chops some of the downside part off, right?
Yeah.
And lowers the whole.
It just lowers the structure. Return. Yeah. So in some ways it's like that example that you gave. It's like a 30% versus 80 or 5 versus 10.
Right.
And that's why I was just wondering if the ratio of the, if you were like influencing the results a little bit by like choosing a ratio that was favorable to it, but it it doesn't help in the runs that I looked at.
Yeah, I mean, this was effectively a very simple Monte Carlo that was kind of pre-prescribed of over a 30-year horizon, right? Where you'd have whatever, 4 or 5 kind of drawdowns over that 30 years.
It's the drawdowns really do kill you, because it's hard to compound back from that.
Dude, they're so hard to get out of. I mean, they're legitimately difficult.
You do have to survive. Like, it's the big bounce up the other side that was worth being there for, if you can weather the downstorm. You don't want to be pulling out. Like, I met so many people over the last 10 years who had sold out in 2009 at the bottom.
I think this is like almost impossible to overcome if you're an allocator who is picking managers and you are going to go. It's so hard not to just go whatever the hot hand has looked like, right? And then
what else are you judging it on? Like, what they're telling everybody sounds the same.
I know. Difficult, huh?
You got to look at the returns, and the returns are just like
well, this guy's randomness. Smart. He's been crushing it lately.
I mean, ARK is a classic example. I look at the portfolio as it stands, and I think that's a scary portfolio to hold. But
I look at it and putting 60% forward
and increasing.
That's right, every day.
I saw that somebody did the analysis where, you know, when she did she start at 40 or 20 or something like that?
Yeah, 40. Movement,
they just calculated down and then looked at that, and they said actually 50% is less aggressive from here than 20% was from where she said it the first time around. It's under one of her. It's under one of Balchunas's interview with her, and then one of the comments underneath is a good one.
And even there's multiple compression in there. That's what she said.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's been some already.
Last time I looked at it, I don't think the multiples were too heroic relative to the market, but the underlying is still pretty ugly. There's not a lot of the revenues are filtering down to the bottom line, but maybe that changes. Maybe it all hits an inflection point. I don't know.
No. I tell you what, if the revenues are filtering down to the bottom line, then there's no way it does 60% forward, because then there's not enough reinvestment opportunities.
I don't know how you can look at every other technological revolution that's happened in humanity and assume that there's going to be all of this profit available for you out in the future, and that you're going to be able to pick the winners of that. Like, airplanes, radios, TVs. I mean, the list is endless of awesome world-changing technology. And yet the ability to make money from these giant revolutions has just been really almost impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you see it coming and switch from one to the next one?
I don't know, but if you're doing any kind of destination analysis of like, what does the competitive structure of this industry look like in year 2037?
Win a take all, baby.
Every single one. It's all profit.
You just got to define the niche right.
Everyone's going to have like 80% profit margins out in the future.
Yeah.
Okay.
Except for the old world companies that are generating cash.
Except for all
cash
those
today.
Hosers that, yeah.
There's a presentation doing the rounds that, predicts Tesla will be a very significant part of the S&P 500 in 2030.
Oh, is that the guys from Worm?
I wasn't going to name them, but yeah, that's the one.
They put it out. You can name them.
Well, I didn't get all the way through it because it was the PEF is very big.
I mean, I like them as analysts. It's not rude.
I couldn't get to the part where I couldn't find the substance of it. I went through the first sort of dozen pages or so, and I couldn't find I just saw the claims. I didn't see the supporting information.
I mean, look, the Gigafactory, all that stuff, it's super interesting, right? I mean, it may work. And if it does, that'd be sweet. I think I said to you guys when Ho Nam, I mean, he said, you know, if the U.S. looks like Silicon Valley, Tesla's going to have a huge market share. I mean, the only thing that I would say back to that is if the U.S. looks like where I live, F-150s, the electric one, are going to dominate. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe the West Coast, East Coast arbitrage thing is real, and maybe it does it again. And like, I don't understand why Mercedes, the EQS, doesn't just look like an S-Class. It baffles me why they made the front look like it does. Maybe someday they'll figure it out. Maybe they won't. But, you know, I don't know. It's possible. I don't even know how to assess the odds of anything. So who am I?
Well, no, I think you can. You don't have to necessarily assess the odds of it happening. You just have to find a place where you're getting a bet that predicts that it won't happen, and then you just have to take the bet the other side. Like you're just trying to find a way to shape the bet so you're getting some free optionality in the bet. And yeah. I don't think that Tesla at $1,000 is free optionality. I think you're almost assuming that it happens at that point.
Well, I think they would argue that. Part of why it can go a lot higher is because there's people like us that don't think it can.
That's fair.
It's the overhang. I don't know.
The valuation works if you can get 50% growth a year to 2030. I fully acknowledge that. If Tesla can do 50% a year until 2030, then it's undervalued here. It's like 50% undervalued.
Yeah, they can maybe do it. What kind of multiple do you put at the end of it?
I was just assuming terminal of like normal 5% for 10 years. It was like that. I just put in a normal terminal.
20. Yeah. But 20 times we're going to argue. I mean, on a car manufacturer, although I guess it's a car manufacturer that has a, you know, monopoly.
And I mean, you can get Stellantis at about 2 turns at the moment.
Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea.
Stellantis was the cheapest thing in my screen like 5 years ago, something like that. I bought some Leaps.
Yeah, how'd that work out?
They did work out okay, actually. Yeah. But it's back now, so the Leaps have expired, so maybe one more time around.
Is it even cheaper to buy it in XOR? I think that might be the case.
Cheaper to buy it in?
XOR.
Oh, I see. Yeah, possibly.
And then you can get their capital allocation without paying some tax on it, too. Right. I mean, that's kind of the nice thing about holdcos, even though they trade at discounts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do they always trade at discounts?
Apparently.
I think they should. Come on. I'm sorry. I'm looking after the dog, and the dog is not cooperating at the moment.
He looked like he was being a good boy when I saw him.
She's getting huge, and she hasn't stopped chewing.
Getting lots of calls to feature the face. Oh, there she is.
She's dropping research a deuce assistant behind the curtain right now.
where are you on the index funds, Bill? We need an update.
Oh.
Well, I have no circle of competence, so indexing would be a smart idea.
Buffett,
honestly, part of the reason that I don't is there's like they've got some embedded tax consequences to switching, which I know is not like a great reason to not do something, but it's also not that fun to... Yeah, I was talking about that Microsoft position. I mean, just like paying 15% to get out of it on a company that I think I like, but clearly don't understand, you know, is...
Harder to get your mind around it, yeah.
Yeah.
Do it incrementally over time, too. It's not all or nothing.
That's true.
Yeah, the other side of that, too, is I know tax rates only go down, but one day they may go up. Yeah. So 15% is not the craziest tax rate to have to pay.
Yeah, that's a good question, huh? At the capital gains level and at the corporate level, there's been the ability of corporate America to keep a bigger chunk of the pie creation than probably almost any time in history in the US. Does that stay this direction or does that revert to some kind of mean when you're running $1 trillion deficits?
You know, the thing is,
print it. Who cares?
Well, here's the thing though. I wish I had longer data. I'll look this up. But like so much of taxes is payroll and withholding, tax receipts, that is, that like maybe there is an argument. I don't know. Maybe that argument of lower corporate taxes isn't the craziest thing in the world. But certainly are lower than they've been in a long time. Let's put it that way.
We got time for some questions, TC.
Yeah, anything to add, Toby?
Hit us with some questions. No, I don't know. Jeez, I live in California, so
you're just used to taking it right in the shorts.
Yesterday was tax day, so I'm still recovering from that.
Yeah, you in the shower?
Quarterly. Yeah.
By the way, Berkshire update. We should probably throw that out there, huh?
Yeah. What are we doing? We're going to be there. We're going to be walking around.
I think probably, you tell me if you guys think this is right, but probably like Saturday afternoon after the meeting, find somewhere to post up and then tweet it out and have people come hang out. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that's probably what we'll do. I liked
Saturday when?
Just after the meeting. I don't know, whatever. 3 or 4 in the PM afternoon or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Follow the Twitter machine. The Twitter machine will tell you.
I thought across the road at the the walk bridge across, there's a bar at the bottom of that walk bridge. That was pretty fun last time.
The Hilton.
Yeah. Yeah, that is fun.
When I was there, but I don't know what time it was.
It is packed. Well, we were there in the middle in the second half of the meeting.
It was pretty quiet while I was there.
Yeah. I like hanging out there. I don't go to the meeting either, so that helps.
Well, I will be at the meeting because it's my favorite.
I go to the first half of the meeting.
Yeah.
Probably won't go back after lunch.
I'll go for the video, and then I will look at everyone that woke up at 4:30, and I will say, I hope that this is worth your day sitting here.
And then you'll go take a nap.
I don't take a nap. Sometimes I watch it, but I just don't. Actually, I do have a spot that I go to there. So I may be there for some of it, but then I end up leaving. And I will not disclose that spot. Not a chance in hell.
If you're truly interested in what they're saying, the best way to watch it is the Yahoo feed from the comfort of your own home. But if you're
then you actually can hear something.
You got to be out and about.
Plus, if somebody, asks some silly question, I don't have to sit there and listen to it. Well, Warren and Charlie think, great, this kind of question again.
I don't know,
like the way they're usually, they're pretty polite about the way they re-answer the question.
Yeah.
I want that full sensory experience of being there. I want to soak it all in.
You want to smell Warren and Charlie?
I want it all. I want as much sensory information as I can pour it in.
Yeah. It's kind of weird, but okay. I respect it.
I bought some Domino's pizza in the stock, not the food. I buy the pizza all the time, and I kind of like it as a position, just so everybody knows I'm long. It's surprisingly
small.
How'd
that get into the
screen? This is the question that I was going to ask. You should explain that. I think
why I bought it.
Well, how it got into the screen.
I have adjusted some of the things in there for what they earn. And that's one of the ones that pops up because it's an over earner on its assets, consistent over earner on its assets. And
so ROIC helps it out.
Return on assets, but yeah. So basically same thing. And it's just been incredibly consistent. And it's one of the, like, if you're trying to feed a family of five, which I am, it's the cheapest sort of thing out there. And so I just, even though I think it's probably getting beaten up because it got too expensive, and I think it's also getting beaten up because grain, wheat has run up, and that's a big input for it. But
they already had huge margins though, didn't they? I mean, like,
they're really a franchisor.
Yeah.
But it's also stock.
Yeah. I think it's getting beaten up because people think, what's the
pandemic's over?
Now, what's the front year free cash flow yield?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I bet as rates go up, I don't know. I bet it has some inverse rate. Everything does.
I don't think it's going anywhere anyway. I don't think it's disappearing anytime soon.
Hell no, it's not. Domino's is dope.
And I'm often shocked at the scale of these businesses. Like it's like $1.6 billion in assets and like a $14 billion market cap last time I looked. Like that's just it's basically neighborhood cafe these days.
Yeah. Well, $522 million of free cash flow, according to the machine. So,
And they buy back a lot of stock. That's the other thing I like about
that. That's probably what triggered it.
Yeah,
that gets Toby.
Get me excited. Same reason I bought HBQ, which the big fella rolled into recently.
That's right.
It's actually been performing okay. It's been consistently cheap the entire time that I've held it, but it's done okay. Which, you know, that's unusual in my portfolio.
Hey, that's great. I mean, if it can stay cheap for a buyback and do okay for you, like that's not a bad place to live.
Yeah, that's the Tootsie Roll versus IBM.
You can make
approach. You remember that Motley Fool ad that used to run?
No.
They had the maker of Tootsie Roll versus IBM for some extended period of time. And like Tootsie Roll was a consistent repurchaser of stock, has been very good at it.
They were saying that Tootsie Roll was better than IBM then?
It outperformed, yeah. Because even though IBM grew really quickly, Tootsie Roll bought back really cheaply the whole way through. That was Motley Fool ran that ad for years and years and years. They probably retired it 10 years ago, but it's fresh in my mind. Love those buybacks.
At the right price.
Yeah, at the right. I like material buybacks because I think it tells you that it's undervalued, tells you that management's doing the right thing. Buybacks to support option issuance, I'm less interested in.
Yeah, that's not as cool.
I kind of like the idea of variable dividends.
What's that?
I just
actually thinking for yourself before deciding how much money to pay out.
Yeah, and as like, a yeah, yeah.
Special I just dividends, things like
that. I know that the argument for buybacks is if you don't like the price that they're buying back, you can just sell back proportionately and create your own synthetic dividend. And I guess that makes some sense to me. But maybe that's the answer. Maybe I should shut up.
Well, you get long-term capital gains too on your little dividend sales versus being taxed at your marginal rate for the dividend.
Yeah.
And you can time it for whenever you want. Like if it's not, you don't want it in 1 year, you don't have to take it. You want it in another year, you can take it.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly accepted as superior.
Do you just mean in terms of like that they treat the dividend, it's almost like the commons treated like a preference, like they have to hit that dividend sum and then they have to ratchet it 5% and they keep on doing that. So they become like dividend champions or whatever they call them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think some dividend people would say, well, that's a good thing because it focuses companies on allocation of capital. But I don't know. Sometimes I just want the cash back. I'm kind of old school in that way.
It's just, I guess, you know, reinvest,
then right? I could sell.
Like I'll say that for Tesla, they found a way to reinvest at a very high rate for an extended period of time. And that's a big, big business relative to a lot of other things around. So he's doing a good job there. You're just paying a lot for it.
Yeah. Well, there's only one Elon.
Dog's chewing on the curtain back there.
I'm aware. He's going to destroy it. It's paper anyway.
I think we've done it, dudes. We've made it.
Woo. All right. Well, I guess we'll see everybody in Omaha then, huh?
Yeah. So next week, I think we're going to take a break for a week. And then
travel break.
Yeah. Got some travel and we'll be back sometime the week after that. I think we'll be doing is it Omaha the week after that?
It's
Omaha,
what, May 2nd.
We're doing our book report on Omaha.
Yeah, it'll be a Berkshire extravaganza.
All right, sounds good.
Yeah. All right.